npr.org.
Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, February 18th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, author Preston Grella joins the geeks to talk about his new book, Internet Annoyances, How to Fix the Most Annoying Things About Going Online, available from O'Reilly Publishing. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek Sean Cleveland, Technical Marketing Communications Manager for Transmeta. Sean, before we get into our discussion about Internet Annoyances and the book, Internet Annoyances from O'Reilly, with the author Preston Grella, I'd like to handle some geek news, if you would please, sir, start with your first story.
I'm actually looking forward to today's show.
Me too. I normally do.
I like the last time we had Preston on. We had him on for Windows XP Hacks.
Great book by O'Reilly.
He gave some good advice that I still use today.
Yeah, me too.
To walk away with something
wonderful
cool.
Little book. And he has hundreds of books. I mean, he's a very prolific geek writer. And he's a wonderful guy. So we'll have him on relatively soon. But first, a little bit of geeky.
Yeah, here's something geeky. Okay. So Dolby Laboratories announced their initial public offering on Wednesday.
Dolby as in, like, Dolby Stereo?
Yeah. And, of course, usually when new companies announce a new initial public offering, they get to ring the bell on the floor at the end of the day on Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
Except Dolby kind of did a little differently. So they kind of upped it a little bit. The closing bell was a special unconventional remix created by Dolby engineers. It kind of rang in a...
I wish we had a sample of this. This sounds intriguing.
It rang in all throughout the floor in different ways. And then it was also broadcast on television in Dolby Pro Logic 2. So anybody who had a home theater system equipped with that could listen to the bell in surround sound. The first time that's ever happened on the floor. That's kind of interesting. Very geeky. Anybody out there with an Xbox...
The Microsoft device.
Yeah, you might want to check to see if your power cord needs to be replaced. Supposedly, Microsoft is recalling approximately 14.1 million power cords. They run very hot, and they've created damage. It even caused smoke damage and carpet damage for people. So just go to Xbox.com. You'll see a big... place to click on, and they'll ask for your serial number and the date the Xbox was made to see if you need one or not. I did it last night, and I did. I needed one. They're shipping me
a
new power cord. And also, there's some Xbox 2...
What was the problem with the Xbox? What actually happened with your system that you need a new power cord?
Power cord runs hot.
Okay, so you just test.
It can smoke or it can cause carpet damage.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So it's just best to get that replaced. And they say if you, in the meantime, turn your Xbox off, don't leave it on. And Xbox 2, which is codenamed Xenon, which will be released in America at the end of this year.
Right.
There are rumors that it may also be released in Europe and the UK.
At the same time?
At the same time.
Wow.
Which is kind of big.
That's going to be a big, every time a new box is released, it's big for the gaming industry.
Yeah.
Tons of new
big
games for purchase and such. So. All right, Microsoft. Speaking of Microsoft, plans on releasing a new IE browser, so a new version of Internet Explorer, version 7.0. And a while ago, they said they're going to stop doing any web, any more browser updates and such, except for security issues, and wait for their new operating system, Longhorn, which is due out in 7 years, something like that. And
I think it's 2007.
2007, okay, well. in any case, Longhorn will have a new browser, of course, along with everything else in the operating system. But they did finally announce that they're testing this summer. They'll be testing IE7, a new version of the browser, which, of course, mostly will handle security issues, which is interesting. Additionally, with Microsoft, they just released a trial, a beta, if you will, for download of XP Professional 64 Edition, meaning a 64-bit processor version of their operating system, Windows XP.
For free.
Cool. For free. But it's a limited trial. I mean, it will time out.
360-day trial or something like that.
Yeah, but it's still pretty neat that they're doing that.
I went up to their website and
got
it, yeah.
Okay, so you're going to install it?
I am. Okay. Of course, you need an Athlon 64 processor or a 64-bit Intel Xeon processor.
Yeah, basically, I mean, yeah, the Opteron from AMD, the Athlon 64 and such will run it.
So I'm going to install it and see how it is.
I'd love to hear about it, so please keep us informed. Thank you very much for keeping up abreast on this. I love that I announce a news story and you're like, yeah, downloaded it, working on it.
Couldn't resist. I want to play with it. So IBM has unveiled a 19-inch LCD monitor with a 12-millisecond response time.
Wow.
This new ThinkVision desktop monitor is very fast. And the problem with
how fast is it? Sorry.
Well, 12 milliseconds is great. Not only does it allow for better smooth text scrolling and video streaming, but you won't get those ghosting and artifacts, the distortions that you see on LCD with fast-moving images. A lot of LCD TVs that are out there, that's like the new fad.
Right.
I don't know if you ever go to the stores, but they never play sports on them.
What happens?
Because you get tearing and ghosting because the LCD is not fast enough to keep up with fast-moving images. So this new IBM flat screen can do this. And it's got a bunch of other cool technologies behind it, like a 500:1 contrast ratio. It's very bright, 250 candelas per meter squared. That's a rating. We won't go into it now. Has automatic scaling of resolutions less than 1280 by 1024. And it's going to retail for about $499.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all.
What's the dimensions?
19-inch. Yeah, it's IBM's new ThinkVision LCD. So something to look for. LCD L190.
All right. Well, I don't have another news story, but I bet you do. So please go ahead.
Actually, I do.
All right, I got one thing I'll throw in here. O'Reilly publishers, for example, the book that we'll be talking about today in a little bit, publishers of tons of tech books. My collection of O'Reilly books, I finally recently went, I've got two versions of this book, and the second version, of course, overrides the first because the technology changed and released the second edition. And yet I don't want to get rid of that first book. Why? I don't need that on my shelf. I can have that recycled or something. But it was so hard to get rid of. I just love O'Reilly books. People might be familiar with O'Reilly books. Computer books, basically, they always have, almost always have, some kind of animal in a pen drawing on the cover. And that animal kind of represents the book. The animal is anything. It's kind of random what it is, but it's a great little feeling about it.
And they've got a great thing going on,
yeah,
for sure.
Their books are wonderful. Well, anyways, they just released, I've got in my hands right now, their new magazine called Make, Technology on Your Time. It's basically a hardware type of hacking. It's for hackers. It's for people that make modifications. For example, one of the articles in here is make your own monorail in the backyard. Or another article is
wait, what?
Make your own monorail. Look at this. This woman riding a monorail in her backyard.
Oh my God, they really did.
Yeah, and lots of people do it, I guess. And then there's a whole article on how to do aerial photography with kites, and your price list and what you need to buy and all that. Simple, and also simple things like stabilizing a video camera for moving around and doing action shots. In general, great little magazine from O'Reilly. I think we'll go ahead and have some editors on from it to talk about the magazine or a few articles from it.
I actually checked it out
on paper. It's kind of nice.
I checked it out online.
You did?
And they actually have PDF versions of some of the articles. So you can actually see what the format and layout of the magazine is like. And, in fact, they have it's a great layout of the table of contents, which are huge. I can't believe the number of articles in this magazine. But it's at makezine.com.
You can also
go to make.oreilly.com.
You know what? Go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show, and then there'll be a little link to O'Reilly.
Nice.
Yeah, not bad. Okay. your next news story, sir, before we go to our interview?
Well, there's a report that plastic is going to reshape the industry as we know it.
reshape, that's like funny.
The technology is on its way to grab substantial market shares in displays, memories, and processors. It's expected to surge $5.8 billion in the next 5 years. So that's kind of interesting. Nanomarkets research firm expects the displays to account for 46% of plastic electronics market and memory for about 38%. And by 2012, they expect that logic processors, solar panels, sensors going to reach billion-dollar levels. So kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Everything's being done with plastic. And also there's the new serial ATA to USB bridge chip that's been released by Oxford Semiconductor. This is kind of cool because currently if you buy an external hard drive, it's the old parallel ATA interface. It's not the new serial ATA interface. With this new chip, you're going to start seeing external serial ATA drives, which is kind of cool.
But is that what will be the bridging technology, like FireWire or something?
USB.
Oh, USB.
So it's USB 2 serial ATA. But you know, there already are some external serial ATA drives.
Well, how are they doing it?
With a special adapter.
Yeah.
With an external serial ATA connector.
Right. Okay. So
which
an
is
external.
Much faster than USB.
Just skipping FireWire and USB and just having it external. Just like
you'd have it connected it all the time.
How long?
It wouldn't be plug and play like USB or FireWire.
Right. How long does a serial line go? Okay. I mean that technology. Do you know what the range is?
I'm thinking a whopping 12 or 14 inches.
Kind of like SCSI or early episodes of SCSI. Yeah. And it's not hot swappable, so you got to plug it in and start your machine up.
Unless the card has special technology built into it to make a hot swappable, but I don't think
Speaking of hot swappable, in general, I'm having a lot more difficulty with the hot swappable tech ideas behind FireWire and USB. When it comes down to if you've got a drive and you are doing something on it and you unplug it, that's very, very bad.
Actually, it's not.
But it is.
No. You can go into the properties, at least in Windows.
Uh-huh.
You can go into the properties of the hard drive and select how you want to interface the data on that drive. There are two modes. There's a performance mode.
For fat, okay.
To make transactions faster. If you set that, because that's not the default. The default is leave it the way it is so that you can unplug it at any time. So what's basically
happening, it's safely doing writes and stuff.
Yeah, unless you're doing a write, you'd never want to unplug until you're completely done writing to the drive anyway.
Well, that's kind of what I'm saying. But,
with the performance feature, you actually need to disconnect the drive using
right.
that little application.
Right. Well, that makes sense that there's two different technologies. On a Macintosh, it's defaultly very bad to unplug. The operating system will tell you that was bad. And if you have an external drive and it's operating, like it's actually reading or writing, you shouldn't be unplugging it. But it's interesting to me that there's not a lot of knowledge about that issue, about this, you know, be careful of it.
And if you do plug in your external drive and you can't see the data anymore and you know something has gone wrong, do a check disk on it. So right-click on the drive letter, go to Properties, and then go to Tools, and do a check disk, and that should fix it. Typically what happens is the kind of table of contents for the drive gets messed up. It needs to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
But your data should be okay.
Well, it's definitely something you should be conscious of when you have an external drive. All right. Our show today is all about Internet Annoyances, a book by O'Reilly Publishing, or available on O'Reilly Publishing, from Preston Gralla. Preston Gralla is a writer, of many books. We had him on our August 13th show last year about his book, Windows XP Hacks, and now about his new book, Internet Annoyances. Preston, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Well, it's a pleasure.
Yeah.
It was kind of, I felt kind of honored that after releasing your book, you went to our website and you submitted a little email to get to our email address and said, hey, the book's out. I'd love to be on your show again. What a cool thing to have an author come to us. I really appreciate that.
Well, it's a great show. I love being on it, which is why I headed here.
Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book, Internet Annoyances. I do not have a copy in front of me, but I do have some wonderful downloads. O'Reilly's pretty good about giving some samples of the book online in PDF form. And, of course, they've got the whole, quite a bit about the book. So I at least have the table of contents and one of the chapters. So let's start with that chapter right away. That chapter, of course, is Searching Annoyances, Chapter 8. So, let's back up for just a second. Preston, what made you write this book specifically?
Well, I've been using the Internet for a long time, since even before the World Wide Web, when you had to get on the Internet meant using a shell account and typing in and comprehensible Unix commands. So you would think that the Internet would be annoying then, but in fact, it was a lot less annoying then than it is today.
Well, maybe for you.
Well, you know, that's because I was using it then and now, but the truth is really for anybody because, okay, then maybe you were annoyed because you had to type in some commands that were hard to forget. Today, though, you get onto the Internet, there are pop-ups everywhere you go, there's spam whenever you get into your email account, there's spyware constantly trying to crawl onto your computer. There's cable modems, which are great, but they also can flake out if it rains, for example. So what made me write the book is that I got annoyed. I have a lot of friends who always turn to me with problems, and it just struck me there were so many people with so many annoyances that I thought a book that would cover them all would help people out, and certainly has.
Okay. I like the cover of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty funny.
A little cartoon of a guy kind of holding his nose like the monitor stinks.
Yep, or there's, right, like monitor stinks, or there's radiation coming at the same time.
Yeah.
So the let's talk about your chapter 8, just because I have a copy of it in front of me. Searching annoyances. And real quick, just answer this for everybody listening, answer this question. Do you spend more time on the Internet searching for the things you actually, than or actually finding them? And
well,
that's a good question. Sean, let's start with you. Do you? Do you do a lot more searching than you do actually receiving the content?
I do a lot of searching.
Yeah,
actually.
Me too.
That's interesting.
So why is that?
Well, that's because there's a good reason for that and a bad reason for that. The good reason for that really is Google, because Google really did change everything when it came to searches, and it made searching so much easier than it ever was before. And so because of that, it's really easy to search, and that's why people spend a lot of time searching. The bad about that is that it's easy to search, and it's really hard to find what you're searching for. So that's really the problem here, and that's what, in fact, a lot of the annoyances I write about in this chapter are, which is that, yes, it's easy just to hop onto Google and type in some words, but then what happens? Well, you know, you get sent to 10,000 search results, and not necessarily the ones you want. So I talk in here about ways, for example, that you can narrow your search. So there's some talk about various, you know, the syntax you could use for Google. But Google is not the only search engine in existence. There also are
what,
some
what
other...
What are you talking about? There's other ones?
Yeah, believe it or not, there are some other search sites. So I talk about, for example, if you're looking for government information, there's a search site called Thomas, which... it's great to know about and really hard to use. So I tell people about it, but then I tell them how to use it as well.
So it's kind of a reference for it's kind of like a guidebook also for using the Internet.
Right, right,
it's not
exactly.
Just what's annoying and isn't this annoying. It's also right. This book's also kind of gives you answers and solutions.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, it tells you what annoys you and then tells you how to fix it.
I love one of your first fixes, handling that problem, not really getting what you want on Google. Add subtract utilities. And basically the idea, can you tell me a little bit about what that is when you're doing a Google search?
Yeah, a Google or any other search, which is that when you go to a search site, and Google's better than most, but it still is annoying about this. When you do a search, mixed in with the real results are sponsored results. Well, a sponsored result basically is somebody who paid some money to put their ad in front of your face or put their results in front of your face. Now, Google's not too bad about it because they do separate it to a certain extent. But it still takes up a lot of your screen. And there are other search sites where you really can't tell the difference between what's real and what's paid for. So I show you how to use this program called Ad Subtract, and a portion, a utility of Ad Subtract, lets you take out all those sponsored search results. So when you go to a site and you do a search, you're getting the real results, not the results that somebody has paid to put in front of you.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Google has that feature of disabling, you know, removing ads.
Yeah, well, it wasn't Google that did it. It was this Ad Subtract that figured out how to...
Oh, I see. A different company is kind of doing
right.
It. Okay,
right.
I got you.
Filter them out.
All right, well, back to what you were saying about Thomas being searching government and the law. In general, you don't normally find... there's a few things on Google that you'll never find. Like, I'll do a search for toothpicks, but I won't find a scientific paper on toothpicks for some
That's
reason.
Right.
And I won't maybe find any legislative things about toothpicks or the toothpick industry. But those things are available online. It's not like they're not there. It's just they're not on Google so or most search engines. Why is that some stuff's not there?
There's something that people are starting to refer to called the deep web. And there's a lot of information that is locked up, not necessarily in web pages, which Google searches, but in databases. Now, databases can be used, of course, to deliver web pages. You in some places you search a database, it delivers a web page. But
and if it doesn't deliver a web page, you're not finding it online.
That's right.
The web.
That's exactly right. And so Google does not really go into a lot of these databases, which is a problem. And so Thomas is a perfect example of when you search Google, you're not going to find all this Thomas information. You really have to get to Thomas itself. And to use Thomas, I mean, let's face it, it is the federal government. And so it's not necessarily going to be really easy to use. But I show you how to use it, how to understand the terminology for legislation, for example, where to search in it, how to find congressmen's voting records, which actually, Thomas is not the best place. There's a place called Project Vote Smart, which is an even better place than that.
So why do you reference Thomas, then?
Well, Thomas, because that's a good place to find legislation, although not necessarily voting records. So,
okay. Are science documents the same issue?
Yes, there is tech and science documents absolutely are the same issue. For general search engines for science and technology, the one I really like is Teoma, TEOMA.com. And I would go there. Same issue. It's going to be searching through databases that Google is not going to search for. And so that's a really good one there that I would check out.
All right. Let's talk a little about some of the other some of your other annoyances, other chapters and such. What's first off like one of your favorite? Let's say about what my favorite is, email.
Sure.
There's so many problems with email. What are some of the things that you tag in as an email issue in your book?
Well, of course, the top one on everybody's list is spam, 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 and more spam. I mean, there's no way around it. That's the absolute number one internet annoyance. There are ways to solve the problem. There's, of course, the various spam software, and I tell you which spam software to use, how to choose the right one for you. But, you know, spam software it kind of solves the problem after the fact. You really got to try to keep off spam lists. So what you really need to do is you need to make sure that you, when you register in websites, I always use an address for Yahoo or Hotmail for address, for example, so that the spam is going to get sent there. You also shouldn't post your if you need to post your email address in a web page, don't do it as text in the HTML, because a lot of spammers, what they do is they sell personally or they buy from people who harvest your email address. And what these bots do is they go all over the web, they look for email addresses, they grab them, and they put them at the spam list. So I show you techniques for how you could actually post your email address without them being able to read it. A simplest one, for example, is you could just make a graphic of your email address and post that on the web.
I start seeing that a lot, but that means that you can't a user can't click on that image.
That's the problem.
And make an email. Yeah.
You're going to have to give up the mail-to link, essentially.
You know, have you in your time in kind of researching this, have you found other solutions besides images? Something that you could actually use or could still use a link to send a message to you?
I haven't found a link. I've found other ways where you don't have to create an image. I found a way, for example, you can use, you know, HTML has codes that will describe letters. So you could use HTML codes, for example. There's a piece of JavaScript I put in the book that'll do it as well. So
oh, great, you put that in. Yeah, I use that method on some of my pages.
Right.
Now what I'm actually doing is just sending people to a contact form, you know, a form that you submit an entry and then it goes to us via the back-end solutions. And
that's a good idea.
That's, for example, why we don't on air always give out our email addresses. Not really because it would be dangerous, because there's probably not a lot of spammers, you know, harvesting from the radio. It's not a very good medium to harvest the spam.
Well, we had one of them on the show once.
Yeah, we did. That was kind of scary. But more to the reasoning is that one central location to contact us, and that's a form, so that when you go to geekspeak.org, for example, you can't find an email address, which is kind of annoying, really.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a side effect of trying to combat spam, but instead someone has to fill out a form.
Right.
And, of course, right now you can do that. If you'd like to ask questions and comments of the guests, go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us, fill out that little web form, we'll get it in our email, and then we'll go ahead and ask Preston your question. So, you know what? Let's do a little break, Preston. You stay with us, please. I know you have to leave before the end of the hour, but please do stay with us so we can start taking calls and such. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Howard Richards, professor of global studies at Earlham College, will lead discussion on building a peaceful world starting here and now at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. That's at 515 Broadway in Santa Cruz, from 9:30 to noon, Saturday the 19th, tomorrow. Information is at 423-1626.
This week in This American Life, a guy, a civilian, a regular person, tries to confront President Bush at a press conference. It doesn't go so well.
Thank you. Seriously, sit down, and I will take a question from you when we get in the question and answer period. Right now, I would like to continue my statement with your permission. Now, where were we? We were talking
about
economic
recovery.
What I should have said,
tales of regret in everyday life this week.
That's This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m. on KUSP.
You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us. We're talking with author of Internet Annoyances, How to Fix the Most Annoying Things About Going Online, Preston Grella, also a publisher, author of multiple books about geeky type of stuff. If you'd like to ask us questions about his books or some of the knowledge he may have in his head, which is a plethora, again, the phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me is Sean Cleveland. Over the Internet via Skype is Dee Dee Hubbard. And our guest via phone, author of Internet Annoyances, of course, is Preston Grella. Preston, we were talking about your... First off, Dee Dee, hi. Can you chime in for us?
Hey.
Hey. Thanks for chiming in. Thanks for joining us. Dee Dee, of course, is in New York at your home, Dee Dee?
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll answer any questions that she may have answers to. And, of course, Sean knows a lot about computers as well.
There's a little delay to New York over the Internet.
Yeah, it seems like that's a delay, but yeah. I'm not sure if that's just the way Dee Dee is speaking or not. But, Preston, let's go on about Internet Annoyances, your book, and talk more specifically a little bit more about some email annoyances. So the removing yourself from web pages to reduce the amount of spam, that'll work if your email address was never on there. But if your email address has been on there, then it's over, right?
Then it's basically over. I mean, then really the only thing that you can do is use a good spam filter. And there's a lot of different spam filters. I'm not going to get into the debate of which is better, which is best. But the real point here is use one. I'm surprised at how many people actually don't use them. So the only answer really is use a spam filter. Make sure it's one that's trainable. As a general rule, what's called a Bayesian filter tends to be more effective than other filters, but that's not even that important. The point is just get one and use it. And in fact, for example, if you have the newest version of Outlook, Outlook has a reasonable spam filter built into it, but I don't trust it by itself. So in addition to that, I use another spam filter, so I'm actually getting two levels of spam filtering there. And if you do that, you can do pretty good. All the spam I get now gets filtered properly, gets sent to its own little spam folder, and that's the way these typically work. There's a lot of different ways they work. The ones I like best will filter spam to its own spam folder, and then you can just delete the spam right out of there.
Yesterday, I did some of my filtering and training and kind of retraining of Brazy and stuff. The biggest thing is, of course, false negatives, meaning that the spam gets through and you still see it. So, for example, I'm using a spam service that's online on our mail server called Spam Assassin with Bayesian filters enabled. And this basically means that I get my messages through IMAP, and all my messages that the server knows is spam goes in one folder, and the rest of it comes into my normal inbox, and I move them to a train as spam and then run a program to do that. For example, they're very effective. Since yesterday at 10, I've had 131 spam messages. 16 of those actually got through. So pretty good odds. I've been training it for about a month. Not bad at all. So, yeah, training spam, very important. Sean?
I'm going to talk about another subject.
Okay.
We also move past email.
We also have two people on phone waiting.
Dee talked about RSS a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And I checked, and Thunderbird supports it. Mm-hmm. I went out and subscribed to a bunch of RSS feeds. I'm hoping, Preston, you can tell our listeners what RSS is, and more importantly, how do you find good feeds?
Well, RSS is a format that allows you to essentially get feeds from either news sites or from blogs or any other website, basically, that wants to publish their information. What's great about it is there's a lot of places you like to get information from. You don't need to go to those places. You just use your RSS aggregator, it's called. There's a lot of different kinds of aggregators. I find the one I like is a NewsGator because I use Outlook. It integrates directly into Outlook itself, and so that way when I'm checking my email, I'm also checking all the news that's coming to me. There's a really nice one called OnFolio, which also lets you grab research from on the web. I talk about that OnFolio, the previous version of OnFolio in my book. It allows you to grab websites, put them in an organized database, search across them, and the newest version, version 2, which is now in beta, that version also has an RSS aggregator, so it's a nice all-in-one way to do it. How to find RSS feeds, whatever RSS program you use is going to have them. When you cruise the web, you're going to see little tiny icons.
That'll allow you to do it.
And there's also, you know, off the top of my head, I'm going to have to look this up in my book, but there's also quite a few sites that allow you to search for feeds as well. And
I'm seeing so much mail or news I would have never seen before.
Yep.
And I can see it in just such a short amount of time.
Preston, quickly, what is RSS? What annoyance does RSS address? Why is it successful?
Well, the annoyance they address is just far too much information on the Internet for you ever to be able to find it all. Remember what you said before about people spend a lot of time searching but not actually finding results? RSS, essentially, you can almost think of it as an automated, targeted feed, except the information is fed directly to you. What's nice about these RSS readers is, in addition to the feeds that exist, you can usually then create your own feed as well. For example, you might say, from all these different news sites, only show me information that has to do with Wi-Fi hotspots, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can really fine-tune it to an enormous extent. It is a tremendous time saver and a really targeted way to get information. As a matter of fact, when I research my books, I get an enormous amount of information via RSS because of that.
All right. Let's back up and talk a little bit about embedding email addresses again. From Santa Cruz, Jay, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, Jay. Thank you for coming on.
Sure.
What's your question?
Well, I recently built my first website, and I wanted to defeat spam bots harvesting my email address. I tried a GIF file, and I also tried an SVG file. And the SVG file that I embedded in my site, just to give my contact info, had much sharper, crisper rendering of the fonts.
Right.
And the file that I uploaded to my site, I looked at that with a text editor, and it was just, you know, strings of garbage.
Uh-huh.
But once it was on my site, so I thought maybe I'd try the SVG file because it looked better. I did, though, through a browser when I viewed my own site after it was online, I was able to download and crack open that SVG file in a way that actually showed the text string, the characters of my email address, of all the text that was in that file.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering, is SVG an acceptable, is it a fail-safe way to defeat spam bots, or does it just raise the threshold a little bit, or is it not acceptable?
Well, there's a few problems with that. I'll address right off before we get into the good side of it. One is that not all browsers can display SVG. SVG is a kind of an XML. I'm surprised that when you had the file in your home system, you couldn't see it as a text document, because SVG is a text document. It's an XML document that defines an image type form. Mm-hmm. And if you have text in there, you're going to have the text in that document. I don't think that spam bots are going to find that text, because they're probably not going to do a searching of .svg files. But the main problem, is that the SVG will not necessarily render all the time. Preston, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I absolutely agree. I wouldn't use an SVG for that very reason. You're not necessarily going to hit everybody who you want to hit, because they might not be able to see it. And I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately that spam bots are going to figure out a way to extract the information out of there in an automated way as well.
You know, the other thing that people do is a flash file. Flash is actually much more, it's proprietary to some degree, but it's much more installed. It's a larger install base than SVG.
90%.
Mm-hmm. 90% install base, Didi. Wow. That's pretty impressive.
You know,
and the good thing about flash, real quick, is that even if in the flash document you've got, and you display it and it's real small on your screen and everything, you can also make it clickable. And most bots are not going to actually go through the flash file to get the URLs out of it, though it's possible.
Let me say something about flash, though. One thing that surprised me when writing this book, We sent out emails, so I had a lot of email, people telling me their annoyances. Way up at the top of the list was Flash. I can't tell you how many people are annoyed at all the Flash animation.
Let's get into that in just a second. And, Jay, was there anything else you had questions for?
No, that was great. Thanks
a lot. Thank you, Jay.
Bye-bye.
The big suggestion, of course, from our perspective is if you're going to put something up that someone has to read, like SVG, for example, you'd have to actually still read it to go ahead and make an image. And you can make a very crisp image in, like, Photoshop or something. Of course, that's pretty expensive. There are services also online that you can put in text and create buttons automatically without you having an editor at all. And you can format a pretty cool one this way. So I'm forgetting the name of the one that I recently found to do this. I loved it, and I'll look that up. So let's go ahead and talk about... go ahead and talk a little bit about more Flash. Why do people hate Flash so much?
People hate it because you go to a website and you have this giant ad that takes over your browser and you can't get rid of it. And, of course, a lot of it is not necessarily done in good taste. It flashes at you. It sings at you. It screams at you. It beeps at you. There's animations. And so it's really a surprise. It really surprised me how many people wanted that annoyance fixed. And there are a lot of ways to do it. I mean, you could uninstall Flash. I wouldn't recommend that. Well, it's tough to do because there's no uninstallation routine, but I do show you a where on the Macromedia site you could download an uninstaller. A better solution are various free programs that will let you turn on and off Flash and even try to only turn off Flash in ads rather than in the content of the page. One of my favorites is called Pop-Up No-No. And it's basically at popupnono.com. That's a really nice one. Another one is called Proxometron. So I try those two. But again, what really surprised me is how many people really don't like Flash.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily the technology. That's the users that make annoying Flash, right?
Well, that's true, but it's an annoyance nonetheless. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
And that's, in fact, the truth is a lot of the annoyances about the Internet are not necessarily... the existence of the technology as much as how the technology is being put to use.
Didi, a year ago, you told me you found Flash really annoying. Do you still feel Flash annoying, Didi?
I do find Flash annoying. But the Flash that I do like is that you can't tell it's Flash. It just does its thing, and it's behind the scenes, and you go on with your life.
I like that. All right, we're going to go ahead and take another off-air question, actually. Jared, called us up and left a message with our producer. Yahoo, for his email client, that's what he uses, is there a way to remove his name from appearing in the from field? Anybody know?
In the from field, in other words, when he sends email from his Yahoo email
that's
address?
That's right.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, I don't either. You know, I sent a bunch of email last night, and for the first time it asked me, they're doing some sort of a spam thing on Yahoo now, where before the email will be sent, you have to type in letters from an image that's displayed on the screen. Have you seen that yet, Preston?
No, but I've seen the reverse. There are services now that where when you send somebody email, what happens is you get a response, and the response basically sends you to a page, and the same thing, you have to type in the text that you see on the page. Once you do that, you're verified.
Right, the email goes out. I've
right.
never seen that before. That was interesting.
Yeah, I haven't seen it going out again, coming in. Some people, where if you want to send them email, you got to do the same thing, and then from then on, the email you send to them will be considered verified.
Oh, okay. That makes sense why it didn't happen the second time, but it happened
right.
with someone else.
Right.
Yeah. These are interesting methods, although it takes more time.
Of course, it does. It's a little less convenient.
It's annoying.
It's problematic for the user, of course, as well. One other question we had from Wally off air in Santa Cruz, he called up to ask about pop-up blocking of Mozilla has been breached. Is there a way to make a window still pop up? Because I guess he's finding the situation he's using Mozilla, and sometimes windows do pop up, and why that is.
A lot of those are Flash.
I don't know why. I've noticed Internet Explorer, the SP2, the same thing sometimes. Sometimes a pop-up will get through there, and Firefox sometimes a pop-up will get through, and some pop-up blockers they get through, and I haven't been able to figure out what's going on there. Have you guys been able to figure that out?
Well, one thing that could be happening is a service that's embedded in the Windows operating system that might be enabled still, which messaging. You want to talk about that real quick, Preston, what that is and how that's different?
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. That's a very different technology. sometimes what you'll see happening is, even if you're not on the web, as long as you're connected to the Internet, what can happen is little text windows might pop up that are annoying ads. And these, in fact, are not web-based. It's something that's built, as you said, into Windows operating system itself. It's called Windows Messenger, which, not to be confused with the chat program Windows Messenger, but thank you, Microsoft, for confusing the world. Anyway, what this is what it's really designed for. It's designed on local area networks for administrators to be able to send messages around to people. For example, server down in 5 minutes, printer going down, or if you send a print job sometimes on a network, you might get a little text box in response saying your printer job is completed, that kind of thing. So it's really designed to be on a LAN. Of course, spammers, being the people they are, have managed to find out how to use that to send spam across the entire Internet. And it's so bad that when I bought a new laptop, within a few minutes of connecting to the Internet, I was inundated by this stuff. Now,
do you address some of these issues in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. It's okay. Easy. First of all, if you get SP2, that turns off Windows
Service Pack 2
automatically. Uh-huh. Service Pack 2 turns it off automatically. And I show you how you could turn it off. It's basically a service. There's a way to turn the service off, really, very, very simply. And the problem is, if you're on a local area network, you won't get those messages. But the truth is, these days, network administrators really aren't using it because they know that people are getting spam on it. So
right.
I show you how to turn it off. Pretty simple thing to do.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time with you. We're going to stay on air for another 15 minutes or so, talking about Geek Speak, and, of course, talk about geek technology, and, of course, then there's wonderful music after us. But, Preston, you're going to have to go because you've got a meeting in a few minutes, I'm assuming?
Yes,
so we're talking with and saying goodbye to now and thanking you very much, Preston Grala, author of Internet Annoyances, How to Fix the Most Annoying Things About Going Online, available now by O'Reilly. You can learn more about the book and such from O'Reilly's site, but go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show to have some links about
this
that.
This book has a lot of good information in it. The table of contents is huge.
Preston is an author of more than 30 books, including Internet Services, and the last time we talked to him, Windows XP Hacks, a geek professional, I would say. Preston, thank you very much for joining us on Geek Speak today.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. So, Preston, one of those geeks that's just such a pleasure to talk with. I could talk with him for hours, even off air. Wonderful to have him on. We do have some calls still coming in. If you'd like to join us and give us a ring about any technical questions you have, we still have a good geek base here with Dee Dee in New York over the Internet joining us, and Sean across this desk from me and myself. We can pretty much handle any question you may have about technology, computers, and such. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go online and go to geekspeak.org to click on Contact Us to get on the show. We're going to go now to Watsonville with Judith. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a couple questions. The first is about HTML. I see on my email that, you know, I can send as HTML, and I don't know exactly what that means.
Okay, that's a pretty simple one. Why don't we ask your second question as well, and we'll kind of cue it up because there's a little bit of weird sound coming from your phone. So what's your second question?
Okay, the second question has to do with listening to the radio online. I have a Mac, an iBook, and I think mainly what I listen to it through with is the iTunes. And sometimes it says, you know, you need Real Player to listen to, you know, certain sites. And it seems like I heard something on the show that, or maybe it was someplace else, that there's some war between the different music players, and if you download one, it can complicate things or something. And I don't know if there would be any problem downloading just Real Player. Would that confuse anything?
Well, okay, great question. I'm going to say goodbye and answer this on air for you. So
okay, thank you.
Stay with us via your radio or your computer if you're listening that way. Okay, first question. Well, the question we just addressed was about Real Player. For example, KUSP broadcasts a live stream using Real technology. The only way to listen to that I know of is downloading a Real Player, and that's kind of an annoyance, but it's probably addressed in Preston's book, actually. But in general, if you want to if you're prompted from a radio station or some other audio source online to download Reel to hear our stuff, you've got to have Reel. And you can install Reel, and it is annoying. It's one of my annoyances online. There is a free version of the Reel player on the Reel site.
Yeah, it's tough to find it.
It's very hard to find. You're going to have to really scavenge to find it. I would do a Google search.
Google.
Yeah. What's your search string?
Free player.
Free player from
Reel player. Download.
Yeah, and then you'll find a page that actually has the links.
There's also some alternatives. If you look for Reel Alternative.
Reel Alternative?
Yeah, it plays and it doesn't do. It's just the player.
Nice. Very nice.
It's made by another company, though.
And how are they able to do the unencoding? I would assume that's kind of illegal.
I don't know.
Yeah, we should have them on and talk about
that. It's a free download, and it works pretty well.
But, yeah, this collision issue is that there is the Reel player, and it will play almost any file format, any audio file format, and it's a lot of video. And then there's the Windows player, and then there's the Apple player, which is called QuickTime player. And all of those do their own proprietary thing without anybody, the other ones can't handle. And they all also cover a lot of the ones that they each other can handle. So let's say you love using the QuickTime player or the Windows player, and then you install Reel, and it takes over all your other files.
Yeah, and the reason it can
really
take over, very insidious install. Don't ever let it do typical install.
That's right. You got to do custom.
And
you got to uncheck all these boxes.
And make sure you read everything.
And basically, you're going to find a list we go through really specifically when you're installing Reel. And that list will specify all the file formats that you want. Go ahead and say yes to the RA files.
Yeah,
and
but say no to everything else.
But say no to everything else.
And the RM file, I think.
And then it will be okay.
All you want it to play is the Reel stuff. You don't want it to play
your
MPEGs.
So just uncheck those boxes. And it's kind of hard to find. Do a custom install. Kind of annoying. Also, it's not uncommon for you to be having Reel, you finally worked it out, and then 3 months later they upgrade and they say, you've got to get another copy, and then you've got to do the whole process again. So talk about an annoyance. That's the way to handle it.
Oh, they'll try to get you to upgrade to the pay version.
Right.
Oh,
definitely. They'll send an email to you saying to do that. Okay. So the first question that Judith has was about HTML and sending email as HTML. Dee, do you want to address this?
Don't do it.
Why not?
It makes it harder for people to detect whether or not it's a phishing scam or a regular email, and it makes your file sizes bigger, and all you're really getting is bold and italics and weird fonts.
Now, basically the idea is the email can be sending lots of things, and traditionally there's a MIME header in the email document. And the MIME header normally says the body of this message is a text plain document. And therefore, it's really text plain. There's no styling. All you have is character returns and tabs, but you don't have bullet points. You don't have bold. You don't have italic. You don't have special fonts, any of that stuff, because it's a plain text document. You can also say, use HTML. That's a pretty common. Most of them do that. With that, you can do a ton of stuff. You can embed images. You can reference images that are not included in the email. You can have backgrounds. You can have colors and all the stuff that you can make the page very pretty. HTML is the language of the web, and it is hypertext markup language. Doesn't matter that much, but it is a text file as well. And inside the text file are these special tags called elements, I guess. And those things mark up the message to have more style to them. The reason why Dee Dee is suggesting not to use that feature in email is that
I'm playing Miles today.
You're playing Miles. Thank you. I sometimes send HTML formatted emails, but in general, the reason is you don't really need it. I mean, you can always attach JPEGs and other images you might want to reference, and the styling of bolding or using really big fonts and stuff, for me, lots of times is annoying because people use them wrong. That said, sometimes it's nice to have a bold in a paragraph, and if you know who is receiving your message and that they have a player that can handle it and that you're in their address book, go for it.
Right.
So it's kind of a back and forth.
Something else, too, if you're using, let's say, a really big monitor and you've got your resolution cranked up, so everything is really small, you can fit a lot on your screen, you may jack up your text size to be bigger in HTML and send that off to somebody who's using a really low resolution, and all of a sudden that text looks like it's 2 inches. Each letter is like 2 inches in size.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of thing going on, too.
You know, I get the opposite from you, Sean. I get most of the messages you'll, copy and then paste in from, a story that you read and add a link.
Yeah.
The text will be too small for me to read because somehow our things are different. And so when I receive
Windows
an HTML message,
OS
X versus Windows. All right, we're going to go to Santa Cruz, take Melinda's question. Melinda, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, what happened is I got a satellite DSL and connect it to my laptop.
And the technician was there and said, oh, it doesn't work on your laptop. His laptop was receiving the signal fine, so it wasn't the modem or the satellite. So I called their tech support and was on with them an hour, and a very grumpy tech guy, I have to say. And he said, going through the, you know, walking me through all the guts of my computer that I've never seen before, that I have no drivers. That's why it doesn't work. What is a driver? Why do I not have them? This is an XP.
Okay. Drivers are specific to each piece of hardware. So the reason you don't have drivers for that specific hardware, this modem or something, is because it wasn't installed in your machine. Nothing lacking in your machine. It's simply you got... You've got a new piece of hardware. Your computer doesn't know how to use it. It doesn't have a driver for it. So,
well, why didn't that come with? I mean, it's really
good
expensive.
Good question. Why couldn't this guy help you?
It sounds like you're having a definite technical support problem. They didn't install the right software for your machine.
They didn't install any software in my machine because the guy told me that all the software is in the modem.
Okay, the drivers aren't.
Drivers
are a small piece of code that allow your computer to interface with the hardware. That's all it is, little piece of code. And it's a very big problem. Basically, you get a piece of hardware, especially old hardware that needs them. So what's happened is Microsoft's been really welcoming new hardware. So what they do is when they release Windows XP, they put in CDs or lots of data, lots of drivers for all this old stuff you don't really even need. So you got a whole bunch of extra drivers in your machine you don't need. The company's assumption is that the drivers necessary to run this thing are on your machine. The reality is that they're not.
So why didn't they tell me where to go to get it so I could get their equipment?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Unless
you're
a company, but
the hardware that you're using to access the DSL is out of their domain. So
yeah, that's possible. Did you buy the modem or did they buy the modem?
I bought the modem. They brought everything brand new. I had to buy the satellite. I had to buy the modem.
But you bought it all from them.
Yeah. And the whole package is going to cost me $1,500 over 15 months. I paid $99 a month.
Where are you located?
In SoCal. And
why didn't you get normal DSL?
Because I can't get it.
Yeah.
I mean, I call them like every month.
We talk a lot about on GeekSpeak. A lot of people call in and emails happen, and I run into people on the street and they say, I'm way up in Bonnyville, or I'm way up in SoCal.
I have fans way out in Davenport.
Right.
They've got DSL.
Right. And so what's happening is DSL is spreading, but there's still a lot of pockets. And so when people call and say, well, what's the solution for me? When I was in the situation where my home did not have DSL, I went ahead and went with another phone format called ISDN because satellite is just not... I've never heard a good story.
I'm committed now. I've signed a contract for 15 months.
Well, you know, if they're not providing that service, there's no way you're liable for that contract. I mean, that's the contract is specifically to give you, you know, high speed internet access. You're not getting high speed internet access. You don't have to do that.
Well, I thought I'd just buy a new computer.
No.
Don't do that.
First off, is your machine a relatively new machine?
Yeah, it's XP. It's only 2 years old.
Okay. What I would recommend is you have the install disk for XP. When your machine starts up and you have this modem thing connected, do you get prompted new hardware found or anything like that?
No.
I think you should go ahead, and since you have such an investment in this and you want this so bad, I would take your laptop, unfortunately your satellite as well. I would go to a company that provides services for computers. Santa Cruz Electronics is one of our underwriters, great little company. They would probably help you out.
I need somebody to come to my house because I want to set up a wireless thing too, a hub.
All right, here we go. Anybody out there that can help Melinda out in the Santa Cruz area, go to geekspeak.org and we'll hook you up with Melinda. Melinda, please send us an email if you would, if you can get online right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
And then you guys can set me up.
We'll hook you up with whoever references, and I have a feeling that I'll be able to find somebody. I don't think it's going to be a big deal.
I went wireless with my compact.
You definitely have a nice challenge.
Yeah, I already have the hub. I bought the hub. I have everything, but of course, I'm not going to touch it.
Right. Well, yeah. I think you should get somebody in. It's complicated what you're doing. Thank you for the call, Melinda.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Oh, Didi found out how to
Yahoo.
Change your name.
Didi, go ahead.
Yahoo.
It's under General Preferences in the Options menu. It specifies the from name, so I can change the name to
anything you want.
Supreme Overlord of America. Yeah.
Gray Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. And our guest in the air room today is Sean Cleveland, and via Skype from New York is Dee Dee, who's just telling us if you want to change your from name in Yahoo, you go to, again, Dee Dee, you log into your Yahoo account, go to Options.
Options.
Uh-huh.
General Preferences. And from name.
And you just put in anything you want. Of course, the email address will still be the from email address, which is also on that page, and should be an email address that people can get back to you.
You can change to a different reply to.
Yeah, you can.
If you want
to. Yeah, but you should make it a viable one, because if you send a message and you're expecting a response, they got to have an email address from you. Dee Dee, thank you. Sean, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of a computer and electronic parts as well as support services. SantaCruzElectronics.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Businesses won big today when President Bush signed a bill that would limit multi-million dollar class action lawsuits against companies. In a White House ceremony, the president gave examples of how the law would cut down on what he has described as frivolous lawsuits.
Asbestos litigation alone has led to the bankruptcy of dozens of companies and cost tens of thousands of jobs. Even though many asbestos claims are